When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette.
I'm James O'Hara, nurse practitioner. And today we have another expert with us. We have Dr. Carson Williams, who is a board certified ear, nose, and throat physician and also a facial plastic surgeon.
Yeah. So welcome back. You've obviously been on the podcast, but
thanks for having me.
Yeah, a little bit of an upgrade with this room. And we have a more interesting list as well. So, for those that have not listened to our first podcast before, we'll link that in the description. But before we started filming, we were talking about med spas and GLP-1s, and basically this area has exploded of what I would consider wellness clinics. Mm-hmm. And of course, we collaborate and are good friends and whatnot. But outside of that, if we didn't know each other, we'd both be, I guess, competitors in this wellness space. Mm-hmm. And we certainly have red flags that we look for from our standpoint. What are things that you're looking out for from your standpoint?
I mean, for starters, these wellness clinics and med spas are seemingly kind of a dime a dozen. There are one on every corner, seemingly. So I think you have to understand that they pop up with much more regularity than larger established wellness clinics and established, in my case, plastic surgery clinics. So for starters, I think these places need to be given some time to make sure that they'll actually stick before jumping in and really offering a full suite of services and claiming to be experts in the field. Red flags are numerous. For starters, just simply knowing the location of their facility and the kind of care that goes into it is huge. I think it needs to have a certain degree of independence and separation from other places. So I think places that pop up within a salon, a nail clinic, something like this, in my opinion, it doesn't really rub me the right way. And I tend to skew away from those. Ultimately, though, it comes down to the training and the certifications and credentials of the people providing the care. Ultimately, if they claim to be wellness experts, they need to have, in my opinion, a baseline level of medical training to be able to be confident in offering those services. Absolute minimum, I think, would be something like an RN who has committed a significant amount of time to training and certification, with a preference of even being a higher trained person as a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, or a direct, director of an MD or a DO that is watching closely over these providers.
I can't think of a scenario in which having, maybe a random MD or DO, maybe they had a previous career in emergency medicine, just as an example. Even if they've done a bunch of CME, I just can't see that being congruent with the quality of having a facial plastic surgeon or a plastic surgeon that is overseeing everything, and not just the type of oversight to where like they sign the forms and whatnot, the type of oversight that's actually making sure that their protocols and treatments are of high quality. Because even something as simple as Botox or botulinum toxin, I'm talking with you about these things very frequently, and we both have a lot of experience with this. But even as a family practice doctor that's doing a lot of skin procedures often, and I've been doing this for 5 years at this point, I'm still learning things. So I can't help but think if I didn't have someone that I knew as well as you, if I, let's say I still had a facial plastic surgeon and I paid him or her, you know, like a monthly fee, and they were just making sure that things weren't, that they, things were okay, but things weren't optimal. Mm-hmm. I just can't see the quality as being the same. And it's kind of the same way when we look at wellness clinics from our standpoint. It's like, well, are you trying to make sure they don't have bad hormone or GLP-1 protocols? Or are you actually trying to make sure things are optimal?
Right. I think it's a matter of, you know, it's one thing, like to go back to your thing about botulinum toxin injections. It's one thing to go through some training courses and certifications and have the little piece of paper that says, sure, I had 4 hours worth of training. I can stick a needle in someone's face. It's one thing to be able to do that. It's one thing to be able to regurgitate basic numbers and dosages and strengths of treatment and areas. That's just to try to accomplish the goal. Most of the time it happens, or it happens very closely. Where the real expertise and training comes in is what to do when things don't go the way that they are intended, mm-hmm. when there's an, to them, at least an unexplained outcome, or God forbid, some form of a complication that then requires greater insight and expertise into how these things work, and most importantly, how to fix them if they do go awry. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think we do have a separation in what people like well-trained facial plastic surgeons, general plastic surgeons, dermatologists, those who have from the very get-go, from day one of their training, have had immersion into how these things work, how they should be applied, and how they should be managed if there is a complication, adverse effect, or shortcoming or ill-intended, you know, consequence. So that's where the separation really exists. I do think that the med spas, wellness clinics, you know, aesthetics bars, whatever you want to go to or call them, the ones that do it and do it best have committed to having a team that is of the highest expertise. And I'm not saying that a facial plastic surgeon for a face med spa is mandatory. I'm a little biased, of course, but I think a very well-trained cosmetic dermatologist is an excellent option. I think a well-trained general plastic surgeon is an excellent option. And to kind of maybe even counter a point that you said, you know, a previous emergency room physician or obstetrician or family medicine doctor or what have you, who gravitates to this space, I absolutely think in the first 6 months, year, 2 years, no, the degree of expertise is not there yet. But just like many things in our lives, you commit enough time, effort, and study to it, you can become expert in it. But it's like the 10,000 hour rule. You really got to commit a significant amount of time and dedication to it to become that expert.
I think that's well put. I think that's really solid advice for people. You're not going to be an expert in 6 months or even a year. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time. And you mentioned, I think, is really important for people to think about, you know, what could go wrong. And you have an excellent case of this you put on your social media. We'll put something in the description for people to follow you.
Sure.
But I remember it was a treatment of the forehead, and you know, something had happened where too much energy was used or something went terribly wrong. Yeah. And you know, instead of perhaps halting the treatment and limiting the damage, it looked to me like they just treated the whole frontalis area, the whole forehead that they were trying to treat. So, you know, these are things where then you get called in as an expert. You know, people are coming to you like, hey, maybe they were trying to save some money, thinking themselves like a savvy consumer. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how do you walk through sort of correcting those things?
Yeah. So I know exactly the case you're talking about, and it still just pulls at my heartstrings thinking about that poor lady. She, obviously, without giving away too much detail, she's committed a lot of time and energy and financial output to maintaining a really good appearance, you know, and it's always been a matter of maintenance with minimal correction because she hasn't needed much. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, if my memory serves me, she really wasn't looking for much of a cost savings. It was just a new place to her, and she figured she'd give it a try. And you are correct. It was an energy-based treatment to the forehead, and maybe we can link a picture as part of this as what it looks like. But basically, it's a grid-like pattern that was created across her entire forehead. And what you can't see is there were a few areas on the cheek and jawline that got the same appearance. Thankfully, those did heal much, much better. But effectively, it was some sort of a needle energy device. It was done so incorrectly. And I imagine that it was both user error and machine malfunction. I think it was both, quite frankly. Instead of recognizing that that amount of energy delivered was far too high and that the machine was not either set or operating correctly, it effectively created what is called coagulative necrosis of every single treatment site on this poor lady's forehead. And while I was able to improve her situation significantly, the last I checked with her, which has been a little while, she did still have unfortunate kind of indentations all the way across her forehead. And so it did lead to a pretty sticky situation between her and the providing facility. But clearly they didn't recognize that what they were doing was actually causing harm and not at all what the treatment was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah. And when I hear you talking about sort of the expertise and then people, you know, going out and doing this, it sort of reminds me of some of the cases we've seen coming from a hormone standpoint or a GLP-1 standpoint, people mixing up tirzepatide and semaglutide dosing because they really don't know the area mm-hmm. or haven't taken the time to read like the package insert to see where do people really start with dosing. And I think the compounding makes it a little more complicated, but it's not really a good excuse to cause someone a harm or a huge disservice. It's an inconvenience at least if someone is throwing up and they didn't have to be. Sure. So I think that raises the question of, you know, you can't be an expert in everything immediately. So in your practice, you know, this is just kind of fun to talk through. Mm-hmm. Why don't you do hormones and GLP-1s and all this sort of weight loss stuff as well?
I think if you try to spread yourself too thin, you start to lose some of that dedicated expertise. So in my practice, my main intent is the surgical correction and rejuvenation of the face, neck, and scalp. That is my number one priority. Mm-hmm. In order to establish and maintain a successful rejuvenative practice, there are some peripheral things that need to be available or offered. So injectable therapies, collagen stimulation, volume, you know, replenishment, things like that. Mm-hmm. But in all honesty, my injectables practice is simply to support and to complement my surgical practice. And so I look at my injectables practice as kind of a relative net zero thing. It's there so that people don't necessarily have to go down the street. They can stay under a roof in which they hopefully trust their provider, and I can take care of those things. But then from a business perspective, if I keep them there, then they're likely to stay with me when it does come time for those surgical maneuvers or procedures that they may want to embark on to achieve their ultimate goal. And that's honestly where I like to be because I went into a surgical subspecialty for a reason. I'm really fascinated and I feel like I do my best work with scalpel in hand. And that's really where I want to focus. So to then say, you know, I'm not super dedicated to my non-surgical practice, to then say, well, I'm also going to personally offer hormone, you know, therapy. I'm going to also offer the GLP-1s. I'm going to also offer a full suite of wellness. I'm also going to offer non-face, neck, and scalp, you know, body contouring or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just don't feel like I have a place doing that, at least not right now. And if I do ever grow to that point, I feel like the best idea is to expand my team, to add an associate or a partner physician who is a little bit more dedicated to and an expert of one or more of those sorts of fields. And so I think a really exciting thing about our collaboration is you possess so many expertise and, you know, knowledge base about things that I am relatively ignorant about. But they are so complementary to one another because many of our shared clients are looking for a full approach to wellness, rejuvenation, and just correction of issues that they may have at baseline. So mm-hmm. I don't have to go out there and kind of take my attention away from my dedicated specialty, I can kind of get both with effective collaboration amongst, you know, friends and colleagues. So I kind of go at it from that way for the time being.
Yeah, we're certainly also firm believers that a rising tide will float all boats.
Yeah.
But, you know,
for the
others,
it's a race to the bottom. Like you mentioned, there's one on every corner, and you don't want to be part of that race.
Ultimately, they're not my competition because I hold a relative trump card in the sense that they really can't do much in the way of under the skin.
Sure.
You know, be it energy, some energy-based therapies, more, you know, hefty or strong laser-based therapies or things like face tight, body tight, certainly no body contouring or fat removal, and then certainly can't lay knife to skin and do anything surgical. So I'm not going to compete with med spas when it comes to non-surgical injectable stuff, but I don't really have to. Because I hold something that they'll never be able to do. So the best thing for me to do is to hopefully kind of meander about making sure that I'm not going to cross paths with ones that maybe aren't doing the best of work, but to hopefully collaborate with those that are and have a symbiotic relationship saying, hey, I can send you guys for things that I don't offer, and then maybe I can be available for those that are interested in more surgical type things. Happy to see them, consult with them, and take care of them if they so choose.
Yeah. And I love that you're you are a facial plastic surgeon. Mm-hmm. You do aesthetics, but aesthetics often has functional improvements,
huge,
even though you do, 100% aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And, you are also an interesting source of information, particularly about, compounded medications, because, we do compounded GLP-1s, and we'll get more into like chin reductions and facial rejuvenation and whatnot for people that are interested. But just very quickly, you're actually the one that introduced me to compounded antibiotic sinus rinses. Mm-hmm. So we just very quickly wanted to ask you.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did that come apart, or for people who want to avoid systemic exposure?
Sure. About that? So, as we said in the beginning, I'm a double board certified physician. So my first training was ear, nose, and throat surgery. So I did my residency in that, followed by an accredited facial plastics fellowship. So I kind of am able to wear a couple of hats. And while I have moved on from my ENT practice and focus solely on facial plastics now, certainly still have a lot of that knowledge base. And so compounded sinus rinses, I feel like are fantastic. I mean, certainly for acute sinusitis, it's probably not the greatest thing because it's more of the long play to management and correction of some more chronic issues. So one that I used commonly was a mixture of tobramycin, which is an antibiotic, mixed with budesonide, which is a topical steroid. There are many different options available kind of within this, but that was a typical one that I used. Tobramycin has been shown to have fairly broad spectrum coverage for these species that tend to be associated with chronic sinusitis. So it tends to have good coverage of those bacteria. It also has been shown to have good anti-inflammatory qualities as a standalone medication. So those are good qualities to have, and it has a good safety profile. Budesonide is somewhat equivalent to something like Flonase or fluticasone or Nasacort, which is triamcinolone, things like that. They're all topical steroids. So when you mix the two together, you get the power of the steroid laying down a really good layer of the anti-inflammatory effects. And I think about it like those natural ostia or opening into the sinuses. Most of the time, they're too squeezed shut. They need to open up more widely. And that steroid can help that mucosa or the lining to be less swollen and allow introduction of both active medications up into all the little kind of nooks and crannies of our paranasal sinuses and nasal cavity. And when it is able to get in there, it's just like putting fertilizer on your lawn. It just covers those areas. It does not get absorbed into your bloodstream in any meaningful way. So you do not get systemic absorption. So that means you're not getting tobramycin and budesonide delivered to your feet. It's basically only going into the area where it needs to be and applying its effects right there. What I think is so important to remember about compounded sinus rinses specifically, it's not even the medications that are within it. It's the actual nasal or the normal saline, excuse me, that it's suspended within, because just that physical washing away of the bacteria, the thickened mucus secretions, the allergens or things in the environment that cause allergies, physically just washing it away is so powerful to allow your body to do less of the heavy lifting and allow that medication to be so much more effective at doing what it needs to do. So I really was a huge fan of that. And just depending on the patient's profile, you can downgrade. So some people didn't need the antibiotic and the steroid. They might just need the steroid. Or maybe sometimes people don't need any medication at all and say, go home and you need to just make good friends with a sinus rinse bottle, you know, once, twice a day, just really rinse it out. You know, don't make that stuff be stagnant. Get it mobile, get it moving, and just clean it out of there. It's so powerful.
Once or twice a day for the medicated too?
So for the compounded medications, my normal routine was, I said, you have to commit to at least 30 days of this and many times up to 60. You can go on for longer than that, but it was generally a 30 to 60 day regimen. And you split it into two doses per day. So you really only make up one solution per day. You use about half in the morning and half in the evening. Mm-hmm. And then you start the process again tomorrow.
Functional and integrative med docs are furiously taking notes. Yeah. You could add that to your website for SEO, integrative facial plastic surgery.
There you go.
I care about antibiotic side effects.
I do.
Yeah, that's good antibiotic stewardship, minimizing the systemic exposure and hopefully the downstream resistance. I mean, I think people are more aware of that now, hopefully. I mean, I know there's people that still want their antibiotic because, you know, it always works for them and they have some anti-inflammatory actions, but I think that's a good use. And you also are a fan of the, like you said, sinus rinses, the neti pot. You mentioned when we were speaking several months ago about the drop of baby shampoo in the neti pot, which is another sort of, you know, trick of the trade that I just, you know, not an ENT physician, hadn't heard of. I'm like, hey, that seems pretty benign, assuming people are using appropriately distilled water and these sorts of things.
Exactly.
To kind of help with the physical rinsing away.
So yeah, I thought that was like a really surfactant. Good, just like really if you put dish soap on your hands after, you know, washing out bacon grease, it helps to break down that thickened oil basically. It encapsulates it and it gets it off of the surface. So a little bit of baby shampoo can kind of do the same thing. Don't overdo it though.
Yeah. And don't use dish soap.
Please do not use any dish soap. So but I mean, I think you kind of touched on the antibiotic resistance thing. It is extremely prevalent that we physicians and providers, we overuse it, plain and simple. We overuse antibiotics just because it is a bit of a fire from the hip thing. It might be a bit of a, you know, I don't have time or interest or patience to maybe delve down into the real root cause of what's causing a patient's complaint. And they say, hey, just here's some Keflex, go away, or here's some doxycycline, it'll probably take care of it. When in reality, I think more often than not, the passage of time is probably doing most of that work for us. Yeah. But I do try to use the, you know, the published literature to guide my decisions on this stuff. The status quo for years and years and years was for a septoplasty, which means to straighten the septum of the nose on the inside of the nose, you give postoperative antibiotics. You do not have to do that. And I have changed the way that I practice. I used to do it as a standard postoperative order on every single patient. And as long as it's a straightforward, uncomplicated procedure, I no longer do it. And knock on wood, I have not had any issues. So I try to follow the literature as often as I can. So,
yeah. So we talked through nose, and I suppose we could talk about throat a bit, or we can move to baby ears. I know you guys chatted a bit about that during the last podcast.
Yeah.
And now I have a baby that'll be due a couple of months from now, April.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought a lot of its ears until I was listening to the last podcast. And I was like, oh, that's one of those things where there's a short window of time to address it.
Yeah.
So perhaps, I mean, how common is it that I mean, new parents are thinking about this. There's a million things to think about.
I think that's one of the problems is that there are just so many things going on in those first few days and weeks after a child is born, even if it's a totally healthy birth and you're not dealing with other struggles. And if they are, if it's a premature birth and NICU, other complications, it really gets pushed down to the bottom of the list. Mm-hmm. And that's reasonable. It is not a life or death thing. That being said, there is a short time window, and it really comes down to circulating hormones within the baby. As they decrease, the cartilage begins to stiffen in the ears. So the best time window is 3 weeks of age or younger to institute treatment. And this is for non-surgical ear molding or shaping. So this is not for surgical intervention. I use a system called Earwell. They're produced by a company called Beacon out of Illinois. They've been around for years now. It's extremely well tolerated, works very, very well, very low kind of side effect profile, and typically is covered in full by insurance. So that's kind of exciting too for new parents who are worried, you know, is this a cosmetic treatment or not? But basically, if you get them applied prior to 3 weeks of age, I tell everyone you should expect a full 6 weeks of continuous molding where it is kept in place there. But sometimes you can get away with a little bit less time. I've had many successful ones done where I terminated the treatment at 4 weeks, and we've had really excellent outcomes. On the flip side, for a significantly misshapen ear, going longer than 6 weeks, I see significant diminishing returns with an increased risk profile. Things like skin breakdown and redness and pain of the ears that could occur because that cartilage underneath has stiffened so much at that point that we're trying to mold a no longer malleable structure. It's much more rigid. I mean, still feels pretty soft, but it's much more rigid than a newborn. So I tried to increase the awareness with some of the primary care doctors, pediatricians, family medicine doctors, and other providers who kind of see children, you know, in the nursery, in their pediatrics clinics or what have you, to try to keep a mind toward, you know, thinking about this if the parents seem curious or bothered by it, because time really is of the essence. You can stretch it beyond 3 weeks a bit, but I mean, you just can't go much further than that. They just don't get very good outcomes.
Would it be safe to say that starting at 1 week is significantly better than starting at 3 weeks?
Yes. I've applied as early as 2 days old. And I will tell you that that child had probably some of the best outcomes of any patient that I've treated. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think I mentioned with my first child, I applied a similar product at 1 day.
Yeah.
When he was 1 day old.
Absolutely.
But yeah. For kids that may have missed this window and, you know, they started to grow up and their ears really bother them, you know, social factors, whatnot. Yeah. What does the conversation look like regarding when or if they should get surgical intervention?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if we've kind of missed the window, that first, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or so to get the non-surgical molding, you know, you have to have a good, thoughtful discussion with the parents at that point and say, you know, I understand and I see also that there's a deformity, but there really is no benefit to managing this until the child is approximately 5 years old. And 5 years old is a good first cutoff for two reasons. One, the most important, is the ear is approximately 80% of its full size and shape that it will be by the time they are an adult. So it's nearly there. So you can start to consider surgical intervention, which can sometimes halt or stunt the additional growth of an ear beyond that. And then the second part is that social stigma. Most children begin structured education at around 5 to 6 years of age. If you get it done at or before that time, they avoid some of the stigma associated with a known or perceived deformity of an ear. So that age is kind of the first time when you could potentially intervene, depending on, you know, multiple factors, obviously. The second one would be basically after the age of about 9, because at about age 9, your ear is very, very close to adult size. And so that kind of the termination of its overall growth has kind of peaked right around then. So I've done them in, you know, kids at around that 5 or 6 years of age mark. And then there usually is a pretty good gap until people are in their teens to 20s, I would say, is most of the time. As we continue to age, the ears get more and more and more rigid. They really establish a bit of a kind of a cartilage memory to them. And so it becomes more difficult to achieve adequate reduction of a flared ear or a very prominent ear to get it to sit back against the head. Again, they always come back out a little bit. So we always overcorrect, and we hope that they stay corrected most of the way.
With a nose that might be very misshapen, often there's like functional defects. Mm-hmm. Is that the same with like an ear or chin if someone's getting recurrent ear infections? Because
it usually generally for an external ear deformity, it would have to be very significant and associated with some ear canal, either atresia or stenosis, which means either total closure of the ear canal or significant narrowing that doesn't allow the egress or the exit of natural wax or cerumen accumulation. And doesn't allow the, you know, passage of sound waves effectively. You got to have a very, very narrow canal or significant obstruction to really significantly decrease the sound passage. But it can happen. It can certainly have an effect. Atresia or total closure of the canal, definitely. And it many times is associated with middle or inner ear abnormalities as well, which that's a whole other topic. And it even kind of goes above and beyond my expertise. For a nose, absolutely. A nose that is not symmetric significantly affects the dynamics of the way air passes through our noses. It becomes much more turbulent airflow, which gives the patient the sensation that they are congested and stuffy. We want flow to be laminar, meaning it basically goes in one straight line and exits in one straight line rather than coming into the nose and starting to tumble. So
that's what you fixed in me.
Glad it worked.
Camera doesn't have to cut out my bowl-like breathing in between.
I'm glad we hit the nail on the head. Absolutely.
Your VO2 max went up too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I guess I can.
From the surgery, not the exercise.
Yeah, definitely the surgery.
You can hop and hop a little harder now. But I mean, I think he makes a good point. You optimize the passage of the way the air is flowing in and out. You not only feel better, but generally your sleep is improved, your performance can be improved. And with the improvement of function, many times the improvement of form follows along with that. Again, a more symmetric nose breathes better. It also tends to look a little bit better to us as well. So that's where that meshing of my ear, nose, and throat initial training and additional facial plastics training really come together, because form and function, they go hand in hand. You fix one, you improve the other. So
does this include sleep apnea, both from the nose standpoint and the chin reduction standpoint?
Yeah, it can help. I think it's important to note that surgical intervention for obstructive sleep apnea is never step one in an adult. In a child who is noted to have enlarged tonsils and or adenoids, in a child, tonsillectomy with or without adenoidectomy can be, for all intents and purposes, curative of obstructive apnea, given that other factors are not at play, significant obesity or what have you. In an adult, it's much more multifactorial. Tonsils may affect it. Adenoids may affect it. A deviated or bent nasal septum or significant nasal deformity. But also, you could have a small or regressed chin. You could have what's called retrognathia, which is a congenital malformation of the chin, how far it protrudes out. So surgical intervention generally is never step one. It's usually a supportive maneuver in addition to something like CPAP or continuous positive airway pressure. And that's a discussion I had to have at least several times a week when I was still practicing some of my general ENT, is that taking out tonsils or fixing a septum, it doesn't actually fix the physiologic problem with obstructive apnea. Obstructive apnea is a problem of a collapsing floppy muscular tube in the back of your throat. And that's all due to basically when you breathe in, velocity of air increases as it goes through a smaller and smaller tube, and it draws things in on itself. It decreases the pressure. Straightening a septum doesn't fix that. In fact, it can worsen it because you're accelerating air even faster, which is going to collapse it even more. So it's not really fixing the physiologic problem. CPAP does, though, because it props the tube open and allows a column of air to hold it open while you can breathe in and out past that column of air. The Inspire device, which is implanted into the chest wall, and it controls a nerve that protrudes your tongue just a little bit, same deal. It's increasing the size of that airway. It's fixing or improving the physiologic problem with that condition. So septoplasty or nasal valve repair, tonsillectomy, genioplasty, which is basically bringing the tongue forward by moving the position of the jaw. All those are kind of adjunctive supportive maneuvers to improve that other kind of physiologic fix to the issue. Complex topic. That makes sense. Barely scratching the surface of it.
Yeah. On top of that, the GLP-1 tirzepatide is also now approved for sleep apnea.
I would actually like to hear a little bit more about this on your guys' thought of it. I think at the heart of it, it makes sense. You know, you can shed pounds. You kind of shed additional obesity many times of the neck area and of the chest and the torso and the abdomen. I can see where that would decrease the overall just gravitational kind of crushing effect, so to speak, on these areas. But is there more to it than just simply losing weight?
Yeah, it's actually kind of hard to say. Certainly part of it is with less weight in the chest, you have less Pickwickian hypoventilation or obesity hypoventilation, because like you said, there's less pressure on the chest, less positive airway pressure is relatively needed. But in our last conversation, I know you mentioned that a lot of times submental adipose, so the fat kind of under the chin, and to some degree the fat in the upper part of the neck, a lot of this is genetic and tends to increase as age progresses. So the physical, you know, pushing of this when someone's supine, which is on their back, I would think that perhaps there'd be some degree of functional improvement after that's taken care of, regardless of if it's tirzepatide or surgical intervention.
Absolutely. I mean, I've never done a cervical liposuction or what's called lipectomy, which is a surgical excision of fat to address sleep apnea. I don't think insurers would be typically keen on paying for that. But it stands to reason that it could absolutely contribute to an overall decreased effect of obstructive apnea if it is deemed to be at least somewhat associated with cervical adiposity or fat collection.
And the other, I guess, bonus mechanism that may be there, it's nothing necessarily magical that the GLP-1 is doing to, you can give people medications that suppress REM sleep and that's going to improve your apnea score. I don't think it has an effect like that, but all of the GLP-1s are sort of growth hormone releasing peptides in and of themselves, which does help to drive a little bit of extra lipolysis. But if you're looking at it like a pie chart, that's probably like 5% of the effect. And the 95% is just the calorie restriction and people being able to be consistent with that. So then, you know, it's all those physical and anatomical things we just talked about where you're just not collapsing the airway because it's not, doesn't have the gravity. But that's sort of a bonus effect and hasn't been particularly well studied. It's variable. I have some patients, their IGF-1 will go up to above 300 on a GLP-1. Other patients, it doesn't seem to move. But it's a phenomenon we've noticed, and I don't think they pull it in these big studies just because they're already so expensive to fund these trials anyway.
Yeah, that would be a $10 lab test. It would really break the bank.
Well, they don't get wholesale pricing.
I'm sure they could. In all seriousness, one other interesting thing about the GLP-1s is the Ozempic face. So now that buccal fat removal is, I guess, currently out of style. And then everybody's, I guess they love their facial plastic surgeons. So they treat them so aggressively with Ozempic, which is semaglutide, or tirzepatide, which is Zepbound, that there certainly can be significant facial fat loss. Is that an issue that you're seeing pop up?
You do, absolutely. I think it's not only just Ozempic face, so to speak, and targeted fat pad reduction. But I think kind of this global caloric restriction, global reduction in amount of fat, if you're removing fat from within a soft tissue envelope, basically the skin, and you're reducing it, it's ultimately going to lead to excess skin, lax skin. And with the effects of gravity, you tend to see sinking in and you tend to see descent of those tissues. And so absolutely, you are seeing some hollowing effects in the mid-cheek and under-eye areas. You certainly do get some over here, or under here, excuse me. Again, some of that is a little bit congenital and it tends to stick around almost regardless, and it can be pesky and bothersome to people. But I do think over the last couple of years, since this stuff has become very widespread use, we are seeing more and more of that, and people are wanting some replenishment of certain areas of their face to kind of get plumped back up again. The fat pad, the buccal or buccal fat pad, however you want to pronounce that, it is prone to that a bit, but I do actually find that other fat pads tend to be a little bit more sensitive to the effects of that, whereas that tends, in my experience, to kind of just stay put, and the way to reduce it effectively is surgical. So it's trends are trends. They're in one year, they're out the next year, they're back in the next year after that. So I think everything is an ebb and a flow. I think it's in my best interest, or facial plastic surgeon's best interest, to be up with the times, but more just up with the technique on how to safely do it and know when to safely and effectively recommend it to patients, and not just kind of go along with, I want to look like X, Y, or Z, you know, celebrity, but what's going to give my face the best harmonious appearance for what my ultimate goal is. And if they're a little bit full through the mid cheek, sure, fat pad reduction can be a great additive or standalone procedure. But if not, it's generally good to have some fat in the face.
And you do see more like men pursuing, whether it's cosmetic surgery or just things like neuromodulator, like Botox now, that's much more in. And thinking of like the impact of social media, I think with Zoom and like teleworking, that drove a big spike, or at least that's some articles that I'd seen where people are looking at themselves on camera all day and they want to look good and feel good. You know, filters that are sort of auto-correcting people's appearance. I know there's a meme going around where, you know, the woman goes into the plastic surgeon and she says, yes, just like the picture. And it's the filter with the dog ears.
We
put something like that in there.
Exactly.
But it's exaggerating it. But to a point, you know, these things where people have this, you can take a picture and all of a sudden you're flawless, it sort of creates a false expectation. So when you're talking with a patient, I mean, how are you sort of setting their expectations, and as well as like setting a limit of like, you can get your lips as big as you want them as long as you find someone to inject it. But I mean, I don't inject lips. I'm not going to do that. You have to sort of say, well, you know, what kind of work do you want to be associated with? So how do you walk through that with a patient?
That is probably one of the most difficult things to do. And that is also one of the hardest things to train someone to do. You have to be a good conversationalist with people and take the time necessary just to walk them through the process. You have to have them have realistic expectations, because the person who does not will not only be disappointed in themselves ultimately, but they'll always be disappointed in the provider that gave them that treatment, because it'll never be enough for them. So there's a certain degree of body dysmorphia disorder that is kind of associated with that. But even people who don't really have the body dysmorphic disorder, you can still have unrealistic expectations. So when I consult with a patient, I carve out a lot of time for them. So a new patient who's consulting with me for, be it a rhinoplasty or a facial rejuvenation surgery, like a facelift, neck lift, brow lift, lids, whatever, I routinely spend 60 plus minutes with those patients. And it is me spending probably 40 of those 60 minutes just laying out for them I even go through things like anatomy. But it's an education and information session. They must learn about the condition and what they can and cannot do to, you know, affect change for the things that they're looking to change. So they need to know that. Then you need to gauge, what are they looking for? Are they trying to look less like their own mother? Are they trying to look like they did 20 years ago? Or are they trying to look like a totally different person? And what are their motivations and expectations? You must hammer down on those things. And if you come across someone who has poor motivations or unrealistic expectations, it's in everyone's best interest to politely at least end the conversation at an appropriate time and just say, I don't think that you're a good surgical candidate for me, or in all honesty, probably anyone, and then offer them additional education and other people to potentially talk to. Because the worst thing you can say to those people is yes. So if they do have realistic expectations, I still try to set it so that they are, I would say, ultra realistic, because surgery is never perfect, regardless of how expert you are and how long you've been doing it, how many you've done. It is never perfect. So in that instance, I give them kind of my 80-20 rule. I want them to be comfortable with an 80% improvement over their current state after we're done. But I do think we can go higher than 80 most of the time, but I want them to set their bar. An 80% improvement with a 20% shortcoming, and be it maybe that neck doesn't get quite as tight as they really, really want it to be, or maybe there's still a little bit of a bend in their nose or what have you, some little inconsistency that represents a 20% shortcoming. They must be comfortable with that before I will be comfortable allowing them to sign on the dotted line to progress through with surgery. So you really just have to have a conversation with them, try to learn why they're doing it, for whom. If they're doing surgery for someone else, big red flag. Every surgery in this realm should be done for you and you alone. So, you know, the person who is recently out of a long-term relationship and they say, well, I have a new significant other and he or she wants me to have this done. Bad news. It's not a healthy reason to pursue something as serious and significant as surgery. So
vasectomies are not in this realm.
They are not. They are not. Those are very much on a little ledge of their own. Those are allowable to be done for somebody else.
Let's say you have a patient that has a relatively underdeveloped upper lip and a filler is not extremely unreasonable. James mentioned that he and I, that's just one thing that we don't have a ton of interest in getting into, because a lot of people who want it, you know, arguably, it, you know, you see a lot of people with lip filler and it does not look natural.
Right.
So that would be under the realistic expectations. But let's say this person also wants almost nobody to notice. Because although it's, you know, more and more popular for males to have cosmetic surgery or plastic surgery done, what would you do in that situation? Would you microdose lip filler and just like do it so slowly over the course of years that nobody would notice? I suppose it would be a difficult conversation to see like what endpoint a hypothetical patient like that would want versus how quickly they would want it changed.
I mean, I think you've highlighted a couple of very important points. I think the best type of intervention is the one that nobody else knows that they had done. So the patient knows, but maybe they're even their closest family, friends, and other counterparts don't really know what was done. They know something's different, but they just can't put their finger on it. That's the best outcome you could ever ask for. Again, it kind of goes back to that motivations and expectations. You know, do you want to try to be secretive about this and not let other people know? You have to say, well, with every intervention, there's always at least some sign that it was done, at least initially. So with things like lip filler, it is not uncommon to have some very mild bruising and some initial kind of, it swells more than the additive volume has actually created. So you just have to be, you know, informative of that. You know, listen, we're going to do this today. Tomorrow and the next day, it's expected that you're going to be more swollen than you actually will be once this stuff settles down. So in the next few days, you might want to stay put, not go out and have a big social event. And oh, by the way, you could also potentially bruise a mild to moderate amount. It's very normal. I consider it an expectation, not a risk or a complication. It's very much in the realm of possibility. So you just have to be honest with them. And I think you highlighted a good point. Start low, start slow, work your way up, be it with neuromodulators like Botox, Dysport, Xeomin. If you've never injected someone or if you're just kind of questioning their response to it, cut the dose into a third or a half of what you maybe think you should put in there, because you can always add more. Same thing goes for, you know, hyaluronic acid-based filler. You can start with a little bit and you can add more over time to either achieve an ultimate goal, like you, you know, said, you work up to a point over the course of weeks, months, years, and just work up slowly. It's so much safer of an approach. But you also have to be honest with the patient that with that comes maybe more frequent visits, or you may have to buy more product because really these things are kind of one-time use. So your overall cost may be increased relative to someone who just wants the whole syringe put in right then and there, or and can tolerate it. So a lot of discussion points. That's why the consultation is so vital. And I try to carve out all the time for those folks so that they can be well-informed, because I'm not there to make the decision for them. My job is to be an educator and, you know, give them all the pros and the cons. And then ultimately, they're the ones that tell me what to do after I've recommended, you know, plans A, B, and C. They tell me what to do at that point after they've had a chance to think about it and, you know, ask critical questions and clarification questions.
Shared decision making.
It has to be.
Yeah. Kind of like when you're trying to decide what haircut to get.
Absolutely. Your stylist is an important part of that.
I love that you're not triggered by that.
Yeah. Our own resident, Dr. Gillette, former hairstylist and hair cutter.
Exactly.
Yeah. It took me about 5 years to get good at cutting and coloring hair. But no, it's a good test of if your healthcare provider takes themselves too seriously in the aesthetics industry. At the end of the day, it is aesthetics and cosmetics.
Sure.
And some people say they're completely against it. And I know a lot of, I'm a Christian and I go to church. And frankly, a lot of a Christian or church influencers, if you would even call them that, you know, I like listening to their tips for healthy and natural living and having good spiritual health. But there's this big trend that a lot of them say, well, I tried Botox, but it just made me look older. And then I tried like aesthetic treatments and it made my skin look older. And now it's sagging even more. And my, like the skin on my face is not tight, although it's probably actually the fascia. Mm-hmm. But they still do their hair and they like they're influencers. So they spend a lot of money on makeup. So I just don't see where that disconnect is. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay if people want to, do things. So like if you cut your hair, you're doing something.
Right. I agree. I mean, in my opinion, from a religious perspective, I mean, I don't think being a Christian or being a Muslim or being a whatever is in sharp, sharp contrast to doing something for yourself that improves your state of mind, your confidence, or, you know, some perceived kind of, I'm going to use the word deformity. That's a bit harsh, but you know, if you've got some volume deficiency or you've got a little bit of a small chin and you're just a little self-conscious about it, that's okay. I think having some vanity is a very normal human emotion. I think it's a bit protective, quite frankly. It helps us be the best version of ourselves that we can be. And, you know, I'm here to support those that want to do that. And I'm never here to pressure those who have no interest in it whatsoever. You know, this is cosmetics is a totally elective thing. It's a very interesting realm of medicine and surgery to walk within, because pretty much everything that I do, you're taking a objectively functional working thing and trying to improve upon that. Ultimately, that is not a necessary thing to life. However, to see the positive impact that someone like myself can have on someone in a very short period of time, relatively, be it a few hours or days or even a few short weeks, it's amazing. I think it's honestly more than what many, you know, SSRIs can do for people's state of health and self-confidence boosting is just enormous. I'm thinking of a recent face and neck lift patient that I had that she pursued deep plane face and neck lifting with me about 6 months prior to, I believe it was her son's wedding. And she was so, so happy with what she had done for herself ahead of this very important day for her. Mm-hmm. And it just made it so much better. And like those sorts of stories, just, it makes you just come back so invigorated for the next day. So those are the reasons we do it for.
Mm-hmm. So. Sure. Given that you're a plastic surgeon, do you like the pressure that might be on you to take a little bit more care of your skin and hair and aesthetics as you age, especially?
Oh, yeah. I am definitely one that trying to practice what I preach a whole lot more. In the last couple of years, I've tried to really take it upon myself to introduce some of those more important maintenance regimens, just being a lot more cautious with sun protection. So I wear a hat when I go out and mow the grass or go to the lake or whatever I'm doing. I wear a lot more sunscreen than I used to, not just, you know, on high exposure areas, but everywhere. And I reapply a lot more often. Just simple little things like that are a huge improvement. Mm-hmm. And then I've committed a lot more to a daily regimen of high quality skincare and nothing exotic, nothing crazy, but just good cleansing, good moisturizing, getting some hyaluronic acid serum on there. And then the most recent one I've started to add in is just a basic retinol. So to kind of get some cellular turnover and to just try to kind of improve the overall appearance and thickness and robustness of my facial and neck skin. In addition, I personally do use neurotoxin. So I inject myself with Botox. I'm probably due for some right now, but it's just like if you take this piece of paper, if you continue to fold it over and over and over again, just like our muscles are folding the skin, the deeper that line is going to become. And so if you can stop that folding motion or at least decrease it, natural turnover of the skin, especially with a good regimen, will tend to decrease the depth and prominence of those lines. So from a preventive standpoint, it keeps your skin looking fresh over time. And corrective action, it does help some with that too. You do sometimes kind of have to prod the skin into becoming its best version of itself. But I do try to practice what I preach. I do plan on in the near future also doing some light laser peels just to kind of help with some of the splotchiness that I've started to accumulate. And I need to do a little bit more on the collagen stimulation. So I'll probably be doing some microneedling pretty soon. And then when the time is right, pretty sure these brows and lids are going to have to come up. They're getting pretty heavy on me. So
probably not going to do those yourself, though, I assume.
I will not. I will not. But yeah. I will plan to probably do that under local anesthesia. So I think that's kind of a cool trend that many facial plastic surgeons are kind of going toward, is less and less general anesthesia or deep sedation and doing appropriate procedures, you know, more kind of office-based procedures, but still offering patients a totally pain-free or extremely pain-limited solution to, you know, doing those procedures. So good oral anesthesia, so like things like pain medications, sedation, and then what's called anxiolysis, which is basically kind of like you've had a couple too many glasses of wine or something like that, where you just kind of don't care. You're carefree about what's going on. You just don't feel things as much. So I will be offering all of those things.
Like the Versed that they gave me before my nerve block for my pec repair. And I felt very relaxed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was like, they're going to put a needle in my neck and I don't care. Cool with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's just kind of that anxiolytic effect that stuff has.
Yeah. And maybe you can review our regimens.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, I think you've gotten better with sunscreen. I think over the past probably
two
to 3 years, I've been really consistent with the, you know, the daily sunscreen. And if I forget, I'll think about it when I'm driving, because I think of that, you know, the picture of the truck driver where he's had the exposure on one side of his face.
It's incredible.
It sort of pops in my mind.
Yeah, the arms. Yeah. A big one.
So
that's where I get caught in the summertime, as I notice around where my watch is. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I need to have more on my arms. So I see that little tan line coming in.
I just fill up my forearm with Rolexes.
That's all you need.
That's my sun protection.
If only.
Not really for those that know me. But yeah, our regimens have definitely also become more robust in the last year or two.
Yeah. And with the, I mean, we did 10 units, 12 units in my forehead not too long ago, and that's enough for me to still be expressive.
Yeah.
But the lines that I have, which kind of slope, not perfectly like flat, because my left side of my frontalis is stronger. People tend to have a dominant side, it seems like.
Yeah, there's always asymmetries. 100% of the time somebody or people have, you know, one brow higher than the other or a stronger muscle belly on one side versus the other. It's never exactly symmetric.
But it's been pretty remarkable to me over the past 2 years just seeing like, wow, that like in the morning, that line is just not there.
Yep.
And it's, you know, like, wow, I thought I was just going to age like and appear older and older. Mm-hmm. But it's actually doing really well. I'm pleasantly surprised.
It slows the rate of kind of decline, so to speak. So, I mean, yeah, of course, we're all going to continue to age.
Sure.
As long as you're on this earth, it's going to happen. But it does help to kind of change the pitch of that line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, reducing the expressive lines or rightids, as we call them, wrinkles, is hugely helpful. Foreheads, although it seems pretty straightforward, can be one of the trickier injections to get correct and not overdo it to where the people have brow descent and feel very, very heavy and hooded from too much Botox or toxin, I should say.
You would be easy to over-treat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So when I do my own, I'd have to look at my previous injection map. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think I only put 8 units in my forehead. And although the surface area of those muscles is fairly great, the thickness of those bellies is not terribly thick in most people. Mm-hmm. So you don't need a ton to get a good effect. So I believe I spread about 8 units. 12 units is also well within the realm of what many people kind of need.
Sure.
But I do always urge people to go low on foreheads to start, and then we can always add more. With one exception, if you've had a surgically elevated and fixed brow, so it's been fixed into place either with suture or something called an endotine or a screw or whatever, a little bit of an exception to the rule. You can generally pepper those brows because they're not going to fall down. Mm-hmm. So you can make them smooth as glass if you want to. One of my favorite ones that I've done more recently is I started injecting my crow's feet. I definitely need it back in there now, but when I do smile, I mean, it really reduced it, and I really liked the way that that looked.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been very happy with my crow's feet. I think I did something like 20 units in glabellar lines, maybe 25, which is kind of similar to on-label.
Yeah.
And then something like 6 to 8 in my forehead, and then four to five units in each crow's foot, which is pretty high. Previously, I'd only done 2 or 3 on each side, but just genetically, still, I was starting to get a lot.
Lower than the on-label,
lot of crow's feet.
You get a noticeable improvement from it, so there's not a need to hit it with a sledgehammer necessarily.
Yeah, just like general kind of muscle density and muscle belly thickness, you know, men tend to have slightly higher muscle density, more thicker muscle bellies. So with that, generally requires a little bit more dose and more units of whichever toxin you prefer. So, you know, glabellar lines needing 20 to 25 units for the Proceras and the paired corrugators, totally within the realm of normality. I believe at one point I kind of needed over 30 to get mine to reduce. So it's patient dependent. You just have to kind of titrate that, so to speak, to each patient. And that's why it's important to establish a good relationship with an experienced injector, because they learn so much from previous injections. Mm-hmm. Good documentation is key, though.
Is there a lifetime maximum units or number of injections that you can do for, say, like a lip flip or this popular jelly roll Botox injection?
You
not
can
really
do it.
Not concerned with muscle atrophy or anything like that?
Not to a significant amount.
Okay.
No. No, I mean, in general, for Botox, anywhere on the face, you can continue to do it safely for a lifetime. At least that's what research suggests. So
okay.
Tends to help. Again, muscular insertions and origins do tend to differ a little bit person to person. So I do think lip flip, for example, works really well in some people, and it does not work at all in other people. Mm-hmm. I can think about my own clients who I've done it on, and I'd say 70-75% get the desired effect. The other 25-30%, it's kind of like, I didn't really notice much. I've had a few people even say just because it is reducing the contractile strength of the muscle, they just feel like their upper lip is a little lazy.
Sure.
But the people that have the good effect, they don't feel that at all. So same injection for all those people, but it's just a very different effect.
All of these things that we've said before are great things that you're an excellent source of high quality information on. But if I had to sum up what your main, you know, this is your main thing, if that makes sense, and I could be wrong, but I would say it's full facial surgical rejuvenation, kind of like a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah.
So we should probably talk about that some, but one of the most unique things about you is you're not just, you know, very well trained from reputable institutions and reputable individuals that are well known in facial plastic surgery for full face rejuvenation. You obviously do all of these different things, not just facelift or fascial movement, if that makes sense.
Right.
But you're one of the very few that posts the cost on your website unashamedly.
Sure.
So, how did that come about?
I can just turn the question right back around on you. If you're shopping for a new car, if you don't know the general price range in which you're shopping for, are you going to pursue a particular vehicle? In my opinion, you're not. If you don't have basic information to make an informed decision, then you know you're just not going to show as much interest, in my opinion. I think that it is unfortunate that pricing in the cosmetic industry still is shrouded in secrecy and vagueness. I try to be as transparent as possible. So I post all of my pricing very clearly on my website with a very clear description at the top that says these prices are all inclusive, which means if there is any associated facility fee for an operating room, any associated anesthesia fee for an anesthesia provider and their medications, that is factored into the whole price, but the consumer pays one fee. That's it. And it, regardless if that requires 2 hours of surgery or 10 hours of surgery, it's the one set price. Because I don't feel that it is particularly fair to pass on exorbitant extra charges to a patient for a surgery that maybe takes twice as long as it maybe, quote unquote, should, just because of maybe their particular anatomy was just a little trickier to work with. You know, I feel like it's just priced at a level that I feel like is fair, it's digestible, it's easy to understand, and there's never any questions about, well, hey, where did this extra bill come from? So I have very transparent pricing. As I'm launching this kind of new entity of my own private practice, I am currently kind of struggling through some of the trials and tribulations of insurance contracts and credentialing, which I don't really wish upon my worst enemy to have to go through. It's a very long process. It's very vague on where you stand with these companies. And when they do finally, you know, give you that contract or credential, many times they'll still fight you every step of the way to really reimburse what you're owed. So what I'm about to publish on my website is also a subset of normally billable services to an insurance company, but I've gone and done some kind of soul searching and looking at things to offer what I feel like are very, very reasonable self-pay prices for people to approach a subspecialist surgeon at a dollar amount that hopefully is not particularly scary, because I do want to serve the patient at the end of the day. So I do take insurance billable cases, you know, lumps and bumps and skin cancers and things of that nature. But currently I'm still fighting through that thing. So we'll see how it all ends up. I do intend on, you know, billing insurance eventually, but that will be a, you know, totally transparent price thing as well. I don't ever want people to feel surprised.
That sounds like a terrific way to handle it and navigate and be transparent. You know, as a consumer thinking about how I might like to go purchase something, definitely like to know the rough price ahead of time. I guess, could you speculate on why, say, many of your colleagues don't post prices publicly? Is it just sort of it's always been that way? Or are there particular reasons that they have, like for a sales, perhaps like from a sales standpoint, they feel like they have to sell the service and then list the price? Or what are your thoughts there in general?
I think a couple of the things you said there. There's a lot of the, well, I was trained to do it this way, so I'm just going to keep doing it that way. By the way, we are all guilty of doing that. I perform my surgical procedures, many of them, in a very similar way to the way that my mentors taught me to do it. Of course, I've modified some things over the years to the way I like to do it and the way that works best in my hands. But in the beginning, I didn't list my prices. And I've come to find that people appreciate it more when you do. Even it feels a little weird sometimes doing it. I, for the life of me, don't know the reason why people would keep prices hidden. I think that the age-old saying has been, well, doctor needs to see you before he or she can offer a knowledgeable price quote to you. I do think that is accurate, but I do also think that if you've got, say, a rhinoplasty, you've never had a rhinoplasty before, save for a couple of very unlikely scenarios, it is never going to really deviate much from that one basic price. So I don't have a great answer for you. I think that clarity and transparency is definitely the way it should be. I hope that myself, and I do know there's some of my other colleagues, both kind of regionally here and nationally, who have begun to be a little bit more forthcoming with their pricing right out there for the general public. I do think it's going to be kind of a changing of the guard, so to speak.
The way forward.
I think so. And I do think it's the fair way to do it. Just again, patients should come in already of the mindset, knowing that this is something that is doable for them and not be caught off guard. Mm-hmm. Because I used to find that before I started publishing my prices. They'd come in, I'd spend an hour with them going through a lot of information. They would then sit down with my scheduler and coordinator to go through the goods, the bads, the consents, and then ultimately the price quote. And many of them were surprised. And I don't really know why, because I don't feel like our prices are anything out of the norm. But I think that they just were not, you know, understanding enough of where those prices need to land to, you know, be where they need to be. So sure. I think clarity is the way to go.
We agree. We have a similar structure mm-hmm. where our membership price is how we make our money and everything else is, you know, basically an at wholesale or very discounted cost mm-hmm. that is not going to, you know, help feed our families, yeah. if that
not,
makes
no
sense.
No surprises, right? Sure,
yeah, there's no surprises. It's significantly less. But the other thing that really helps with is if there's a patient that you're doing full facial rejuvenation on mm-hmm. and you do recommend more things than the patient thought at first,
sure.
they at least know. Like if I was doing that, then I would know Dr. Williams is not adding this because mm-hmm. He's trying to make – or not that he's trying to make, that Dr. Williams is not adding this because he's subconsciously trying to make more money. He's adding this because he thinks that it's going to lead to a better outcome.
Sure.
Because money is just not even an unconscious or subconscious, mm-hmm. Aspect. When someone comes in, I guess it depends on the person, but do you generally like people that come in with their spouses or come in with their siblings or come in by themselves? Or how do you, how to adjust the social component of consults?
I will happily speak with anybody, whether they're by themselves or, you know, with a spouse, a friend, a family member, what have you. Of course, if it's a minor, that's a different issue. Yep. But I do believe that having another set of ears is immensely helpful, because whether people are seeking out an elective treatment or for some of the folks that I do help with, you know, large cancer defect surgery, they're already kind of in a certain state of shock. They don't listen fully. They don't absorb fully. And having that extra set of ears is so important. So I love it when it becomes a, you know, 3 or 4-way conversation amongst me and the patient and those close to him or her. So I always encourage it. Actually, one of my mentors in training, he was a rhinoplasty and nasal surgery specialist. He practiced, if my memory serves me, for 43 years, wow. uninterrupted at one institution. He had phenomenal outcomes, and he never once underwent a single degree of litigation against him, which is uncommon.
Wow. That's crazy.
He summed it all up and attributed a lot of that to he insisted another person be with them. Mm. He maybe took it a little further than maybe is reasonable, but he also had pretty much everybody go through kind of a bit of like a psychiatric kind of rundown, just to make sure that they were, again, motivations and expectations were appropriate. Mm-hmm. I think realistically that doesn't happen very often in most practices, but I do think you have to glean some of that information in your discussion. Maybe not on pen and paper. We're using pen and paper, but you got to talk about some of that stuff. So having that support there is huge. Having that there after any intervention is even more important, because even if you get the best outcomes in the world, post-operative blues are so, so real. Everybody, for the most part, is a little down and out days 2, 3, 4, 7, even sometimes after surgery, because initially sometimes things look and feel a little worse than they will. So that support system is so, so important. So I love having a group.
Yeah. Speaking of litigations and accusations, this might be a fun one. Not what people are expecting, but we've been accused of having fake hair and faking our voices.
Oh.
So if someone does want to change their voice.
Hair. Yeah.
So I'm going to start talking in my real voice now. No. But I think we had a comment that may have asked this, but
you came out of the room like that.
How do I lower my voice without smoking cigs? So I don't know. I actually haven't looked into how voice development and what sets that tone. I will say probably the deepest voice I've ever had a consult with a patient on. Guy had a testosterone of like 50. He had a pituitary tumor.
Oh, yeah.
But he had been on testosterone in the past, and I don't know, something with the timing perhaps, but he had a very, very deep, like a lot of bass in the voice.
Yeah.
So I'm just personally curious, and one of our commenters is curious, what are those things that can impact the voice either during development, puberty, or later on in life?
Generally, having excellent control of your laryngeal or voice box muscles can lead to a deeper or a higher pitched voice. Just like some people can, wink both eyes and some people can only wink one, certain people have better control over those muscles. If you speak to skilled speakers and vocalists, singers, especially those that have undergone any form of formal training for it, they tend to command that degree of control over these muscles in a much, much better way. It's a pretty basic thought, though. Our vocal cords, this is a huge topic, but we're going to focus kind of on just the initial pitch of the voice, not dealing with things like resonance, which is due to how open your back of your throat is, your nasal passageway, your sinuses, your oral cavity, the size. I'm thinking like Freddie Mercury, right? He had like extra teeth or an enlarged maxilla, so he was able to hit different pitches. But the point is, that's another whole topic. But for just the voice box or the larynx itself, the longer your vocal cord is or is made to become, kind of stretching it out and loosening it, it tends to decrease your pitch, making it deeper. Just like if you were to kind of flick a stretched rubber band and then stretch it while it's vibrating, you can actually audibly hear the pitch increase. So if you tighten that cord, you're going to increase the pitch. So a looser cord basically is going to have a deeper bass tone. So I wish it was kind of equivalent to like a guitar string. The thicker strings have a deeper pitch, but it's not so much due to physical bulk of the cord. It's kind of the length and the tautness of that cord. And then the power at which the air is pushed past it. You got to have some thoracic control there to control how fast is that air going past your cords. It's all about the vibratory characteristics of your vocal cords.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I'm a self-admitted terrible singer. I don't have a lot of control in terms of like pitch.
Yeah.
But I can recall like even when I was 20 years old, in the hospital night shift, patients would say, oh, like you have the voice for radio. Mm-hmm. And I say, yeah. And mom always said I had the face for it too. And we'd have a good chuckle and that kind of thing.
Sure.
But it's really interesting. I didn't know. And
well, and you kind of also touched on like, other than smoking cigarettes or inhaling different, gases or smoke or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. What that's doing is it's, again, changing the vibratory characteristics of a cord. And many times it's due to onboard edema or swelling of the cords themselves that change the vibratory characteristics, or in some instances, you develop growths, be it polyps, nodules, cysts, or in some cases, malignancies or premalignant lesions of the cords, which again, it's all changing the way in which those things are able to vibrate together. So,
do you do anything, or have you in the past with, like, I suppose the rehab process, right? So these people mm-hmm. that are performers and they, you know, I mean, they go on incredible tours and they're pushing their vocal cords to the limit mm-hmm. night after night. I mean, I guess you can have a strain. They can develop polyps probably just because of the overuse. Something like that. You can tell me more than I can tell you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But did you have any role in the management, or could you talk to some of those things?
Yeah. I mean, I will fully admit that I never got into a huge deep dive into complex laryngeal problems, you know, be it dysphonia, which is the inability to speak clearly. And there's a bunch of different topics there. The really, really high level people are called a laryngologist. They basically specialize in speech and swallow, because the larynx itself is integral to both. For those that have overused their voice, it's basically kind of like an acquired form of laryngitis. You treat it just like you would any other acute swelling condition. You know, it's kind of you rest it, you ice it if you can. You support their care, and you do just usually have to give it some time. If there's been some secondary things occur, like an acute laryngitis situation in which a cord is continued to be used poorly, can develop things like edematous polyps or cysts and stuff. And you sometimes do have to manage those more aggressively, either surgically with medication, voice therapy, or some combination of all of the above. For those that have undergone or had an injury or a previous surgery and one cord doesn't move the way that it should, so it's either fully paralyzed or it's what's called paretic, meaning it's weak and it doesn't come together with the other cord, there are different forms of injectable therapy where you can actually put filler into the cord or right near the cord, and it basically pushes it over closer to the other one so it can vibrate better. You can also have small implants placed that push the cord over. It's called medialization. And then conversely, you can have the cord lateralized and brought away from the midline. I didn't ever do really any of those in practice. I, of course, went through a bunch of it in my training. It was just never a strong passion of mine. So I usually passed the baton to others. We're very fortunate here in the Kansas City area that we have some really, really excellent dedicated laryngologists here at our university health system. I trained with them when I was in medical school. And so people who needed complex issues, I would generally send their way. And then there's some centers of excellence across the country. Like if you go to walk the halls of Vanderbilt, Department of Otolaryngology, it's just lined with pictures of signed, vocal artists who have come through there and had treatment. There's a guy in Boston and another one in Philadelphia who were really well-known voice specialists. So
Vanderbilt is where I'm headed to speak at scale in May. If I can convince you to come with me, maybe not.
We can make that happen. Could be fun.
I think we've covered an excellent array of topics today.
Yeah, I agree.
I suppose we didn't really cover lasers or PRP or exosomes.
There's
or hair,
always
but
another
there's
episode.
More, there's more podcasts.
Absolutely. I would love to do another one. That'd be great.
Yeah. For the listeners, obviously, thank you for your time, but please let us or Dr. Williams know all of your questions or comments in all of the comment sections, whether they're nice or mean, anything stimulates the algorithm. If you can drop a comment, or if you think James's voice is now real, maybe drop a comment as well. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll obviously post your clinic's website and where people can find you below, but is there a specific spot where people should go to?
I can be contacted through my website is a great one. It's www.cwfps.com. So Carson Williams, facial plastic surgery. My Instagram as well. I can, receive and send back DMs through there. I think those are the two best ways. Email is also included on my website. I'm happy to receive any messages.
Perfect. Thank you for joining us again. It's a pleasure every time.
Thank you.
And to all the listeners, may God bless you with health and happiness.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.